Streisand developed overwhelming performance anxiety at the height of her career. For 27 years, she refused to perform for money, appearing live only at charity events where she believed the pressure on her was less intense. Carly Simon abandoned the stage for 7 years after collapsing from nerves before a concert in front of 10,000 people in Pittsburgh in 1981. When she resumed performing, she would sometimes drive needles into her skin or ask her band to spank her before going on stage to distract her from her anxiety. The singer Donny Osmond quit performing for a number of years because of panic attacks. He is now a spokesman for the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. The comedian Jay Moore tells a story about frantically trying to pop a Klonopin on live television to stave off what he feared would be a career-ending panic attack while performing a skit on Saturday Night Live. What saved Moore on that occasion was not the Klonopin, but the distracting hilarity of his sketchmate Chris Farley. A few years ago, Hugh Grant announced his semi-retirement from acting because of the panic attacks he'd get when the cameras started rolling. He survived one film only by filling himself full of lorazepam, the short-acting benzodiazepine with the trade name Ativan. "I had all these panic attacks," he said. "They're awful. I freeze like a rabbit. Can't speak, can't think, sweating like a bull. When I got home from doing that job, I said to myself, no more acting. End of films." Ricky Williams, who won the Heisman Trophy in 1998, retired from the National Football League for several years because of his anxiety. Social interactions made him so nervous that he would give interviews only while wearing his football helmet. For a time, Williams took Paxil for his anxiety, and he briefly became a pitchman for SmithKline Beecham, though he later told the Miami Herald that marijuana worked 10 times better for me than Paxil. Elfriede Jelinek, the Austrian novelist who won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 2004, refused to accept her award in person because her acute social phobia made it impossible to bear being looked at in public. Cicero, Demosthenes, Gladstone, Olivier, Streisand, Wilberforce, physicians and scientists and statesmen, Oscar winners and Heisman winners and Nobel laureates, Gandhi and Jefferson and Moses. Shouldn't I draw consolation from the knowledge that so many people, so much greater than I am, have been, at times, undone by their stage fright? And shouldn't their ability to persevere and, in some cases, to overcome their anxiety, give me hope and inspiration? Why should the thought that others are thinking about us affect our capillary circulation? Charles Darwin, The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, 1872. The symptoms of performance anxiety can sometimes take the form of what seems to be a terrible joke custom designed to humiliate. John Marshall, Social Phobia, 1994. The DSM officially divides social anxiety disorder into 2 subtypes, specific and general. Those patients diagnosed with specific social anxiety disorder have anxiety attached to very particular circumstances, almost always relating to some form of public performance. By far, the most common specific social phobia is the fear of public speaking. But others include the fear of eating in public, the fear of writing in public, and the fear of urinating in a public restroom. A startlingly large number of people arrange their lives around not eating in front of people, or are filled with dread at the prospect of having to sign a check in front of other people, or suffer what's known as periuresis when standing at a urinal. Patients suffering from the general subtype of social anxiety disorder feel distress in any social context. Routine events such as cocktail parties, business meetings, job interviews, and dinner dates can be occasion for significant emotional anguish and physical symptoms. For the more severely afflicted, life can be an unremitting misery. The most mundane social interaction, talking to a store clerk or engaging in water cooler chit-chat, induces a kind of terror. Many social phobics endure lives of terrible loneliness and professional impairment. Studies find strong links between social phobia and both depression and suicide. Social phobics are also, unsurprisingly, highly prone to alcoholism and drug abuse. Early in his career, Sigmund Freud took cocaine to medicate his social anxiety before salons at the home of one of his mentors. The terrible irony of social phobia is that one of the things people suffering from it fear most is having their anxiety exposed, which is precisely what the symptoms of this anxiety serve to do. Social phobics worry that their interpersonal awkwardness or the physical manifestations of anxiety, their blushing and shaking and stammering and sweating, will somehow reveal them to be weak or incompetent. So they get nervous, and then they stammer or blush, which makes them more nervous, which makes them stammer and blush more, which propels them into a vicious cycle of increasing anxiety and deteriorating performance. Blushing is infernal in this regard. The first case study of erythrophobia, the fear of blushing in public, was published in 1846 by a German physician who described a 21-year-old medical student driven to suicide by shame over his uncontrolled blushing. A few years later, Darwin would dedicate a full chapter of The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals to his theory of blushing, observing how at the moment of most wanting to hide one's anxiety, blushing betrays it. It is not a simple act of reflecting on our own appearance, but the thinking of others thinking of us which excites a blush, Darwin wrote. It is notorious that nothing makes a shy person blush so much as any remark, however slight, on his personal appearance. Darwin was right. I've had colleagues prone to nervous blushing, and nothing makes them glow redder than to have their blushing publicly remarked upon. Before her wedding, one such colleague tried multiple combinations of drug treatments and even contemplated surgery in hopes of sparing herself what she believed would be intolerable humiliation. Every year, thousands of nervous blushers undergo an endoscopic transthoracic sympathectomy, which involves destroying the ganglion of a sympathetic nerve located near the ribcage. I, who am fortunate not to count blushing among one of my regular nervous symptoms, observe her and think how silly she is to believe that blushing at her wedding would be humiliating. And then I think how ashamed I was of sweating and trembling at my own wedding, and wonder if I am not any less silly than she. Shame, perhaps, is the operative emotion here, the engine that underlies both the anxiety and the blushing. In 1839, Thomas Burgess, a British physician, argued in The Physiology or Mechanism of Blushing that God had designed blushing so that the soul might have sovereign power of displaying in the cheeks the various internal emotions of the moral feelings. Blushing, he wrote, can serve as a check on ourselves and as a sign to others that we're violating rules which ought to be held sacred. For Burgess, as for Darwin, blushing is physiological evidence of both our self-consciousness and our sociability, a manifestation of not only our awareness of ourselves, but our sensitivity to how others perceive us. Later work by Darwin, as well as by modern evolutionary biologists, posits that blushing is not only a signal from our bodies to ourselves that we're committing some kind of shameful social transgression, you can feel yourself blush by the warming of your skin, but also a signal to others that we are feeling modest and self-conscious. It's a way of showing social deference to higher-ranking members of the species, and it is, as Burgess would have it, a check on our antisocial impulses, keeping us from deviating from prevailing social norms. Social anxiety and the blushing it produces can be evolutionarily adaptive. The behavior it promotes can preserve social comity and can keep us from being ostracized from the tribe. Though social anxiety disorder, as an official diagnosis, is relatively new in the history of psychiatry, it was born in 1980 when the disease was one of the new anxiety disorders carved out of the old Freudian neuroses by the third edition of the DSM. The syndrome it describes is age-old, and the symptoms are consistent from age to age. The term social phobia first appeared in 1903, when Pierre Janet, an influential French psychiatrist who was a contemporary and rival of Freud, published a taxonomy of mental illnesses that classified erythrophobia among what he called phobie sociale or phobie de la société. Writing in 1901, Paul Hartenberg, a French novelist and psychiatrist, described a syndrome whose constellation of physical and emotional symptoms corresponds remarkably to the DSM-5 definition of social anxiety disorder. The social phobic, timide, fears other people, lacks self-confidence, and eschews social interactions, Hartenberg wrote in Les timides et la timidité. In anticipation of social situations, Hartenberg's social phobic experiences physical symptoms such as a racing heart, chills, hyperventilation, sweating, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, trembling, difficulty speaking, choking, and shortness of breath, plus a dulling of the senses and mental confusion. The social phobic also always feels ashamed. Hartenberg even anticipates the modern distinction between people who feel anxious in all social situations and those who experience anxiety only before public performances, a particularized emotional experience he called TRAC, which he described as afflicting many academics, musicians, and actors before a lecture or performance. This experience, Hartenberg writes, is like vertigo or seasickness. It descends suddenly, often without warning. Yet despite what seems to be the consistency in descriptions of social anxiety across the millennia, the diagnosis of social anxiety disorder remains controversial in some quarters, even after the syndrome was formally inscribed in the DSM in 1980. Diagnoses of social phobia remained rare for a number of years. Western psychotherapists tended to see it as a predominantly Asian disorder, a condition that flourished in the shame-based cultures, as anthropologists describe them, of Japan and South Korea, where correct social behavior is highly valued. In Japanese psychiatry, a condition called Taijin Kyofu Sho, roughly comparable to what we call social anxiety disorder, has long been one of the most frequent diagnoses. A cross-cultural comparison conducted in 1994 suggested that the relative prevalence of social phobia symptoms in Japan could be related to the socially promoted show of shame among Japanese people. Japanese society itself, the lead researcher of the survey argued, could be considered pseudo-sociophobic because feelings and behaviors that in the West would be considered psychiatric symptoms, excessive shame, avoidance of eye contact, elaborate displays of deference, are cultural norms in Japan. If nothing else, this demonstrates the complex ways in which culture and medicine interact. What's normal, even valorized in one culture, is considered pathological in another. In the United States, social anxiety disorder found an early champion in Michael Leibowitz, a psychiatrist at Columbia University who had served on the DSM subcommittee that brought the disease into official existence. In 1985, Leibowitz published an article in the Archives of General Psychiatry called Social Anxiety, the Neglected Disorder, in which he argued that the disease was woefully underdiagnosed and undertreated. Leibowitz also developed what became the standard psychological rating scale for measuring a patient's degree of social anxiety. After the article appeared, research on social phobia began to accrete slowly. As recently as 1994, the term social anxiety disorder had appeared only 50 times in the popular press. 5 years later, it had appeared hundreds of thousands of times. What accounts for the disorder's colonization of the popular imagination? Largely, this single event. The Food and Drug Administration's approval of Paxil for the treatment of social anxiety disorder in 1999. Paxil had earlier been approved for the treatment of depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and generalized anxiety disorder. Smith Kline Beecham quickly launched a multi-million dollar advertising campaign aimed at both psychiatrists and the general public. "Imagine you were allergic to people," went the text of one widely distributed Paxil ad. "You blush, sweat, shake, even find it hard to breathe. That's what social anxiety disorder feels like." Propelled by the sudden cultural currency of the disease, that same ad claimed that over 10 million Americans were suffering from social anxiety disorder. Prescriptions of Paxil exploded. The drug passed Prozac and Zoloft to become the nation's best-selling SSRI antidepressant medication. Before 1980, no one had ever been diagnosed with social anxiety disorder. 20 years later, studies were estimating that some 10 million to 20 million Americans qualified for the diagnosis. Today, the official statistics from the National Institute of Mental Health say that more than 10% of Americans will suffer from social anxiety disorder at some point in their lifetimes, and that some 30% of these people will suffer acute forms of it. Studies in reputable medical journals present similar statistics. No wonder there's controversy. From zero patients to tens of millions of them in the course of less than 20 years. It's easy to lay out the cynical plot. A squishy new psychiatric diagnosis is invented. Initially, very few patients are deemed to be ill with it. Then a drug is approved to treat it. Suddenly, diagnoses explode. The pharmaceutical industry reaps billions of dollars in profit. Moreover, these critics say, there's another name for the syndrome ostensibly afflicting those with social anxiety disorder. It's called shyness, a common temperamental disposition that should hardly be considered a mental illness. In 2007, Christopher Lane, a professor of English at Northwestern University, published a book-length version of this argument, Shyness: How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness, claiming that psychiatrists, in cahoots with the pharmaceutical industry, had succeeded in pathologizing an ordinary character trait. Lane's book is representative of a substantial and ever-growing literature that accuses the pharmaceutical industrial complex of creating new disease categories for profit. I will have more to say about this in Part 3. On the one hand, the sudden explosion in diagnoses of social anxiety disorder surely does speak to the power of the pharmaceutical industry's marketing efforts to manufacture demand for a product. Besides, some quotient of nervousness about social interactions is normal. How many of us don't feel some discomfort at the prospect of having to make small talk with strangers at a party? Who doesn't feel some measure of anxiety at having to perform in public or to be judged by an audience? Such anxiety is healthy, even adaptive. To define such discomfort as something that needs to be treated with pills is to medicalize what is merely human. All of which lends weight to the idea of social anxiety disorder as nothing more than a profit-seeking concoction of the pharmaceutical industry. On the other hand, I can tell you, both from extensive research and from first-hand experience, that as convincing as the case made by Lane and his fellow anti-pharma critics can be, the distress felt by some social phobics is real and intense. Are there some normally shy people, not mentally ill or in need of psychiatric attention, who get swept up in the broad diagnostic category of social anxiety disorder, which has been swollen by the profit-seeking imperatives of the drug companies? Surely. But are there also socially anxious people who can legitimately benefit from medication and other forms of psychiatric treatment, who in some cases are saved by medication from alcoholism, despair, and suicide? I think there are. A few years ago, The magazine I work for published an essay about the challenges of being an introvert. Not long after that, this letter arrived at my office. I just read your article on introversion. A year ago, my 26-year-old son bemoaned the fact he was an introvert. I assured him he was fine. We are all quiet introverts in our family. 3 months ago, he left us a note, bought a shotgun, and killed himself. In his note, he said he wasn't wired right. He felt anxious and awkward around people, and he couldn't go on. He was smart, gentle, and very educated. He had just started an internship dealing with the public, and I think it pushed him over the edge. I wish he had said something before he bought the gun. It seems he thought it was his only option. This was a guy who got nervous before getting his blood drawn. You can't imagine how horrible it has been. One study has found that up to 23% of patients diagnosed with social anxiety disorder attempt suicide at some point. Who wants to argue that they are just shy, or that a drug that might have mitigated their suffering was purely a play for profit? No passion so effectively robs the mind of acting and reasoning as fear. Edmund Burke, A Philosophical Inquiry into the Origin of Our Ideas of the Sublime and Beautiful, 1756. As best I can recall, my performance anxiety blossomed when I was 11. Before then, I had made presentations in class and in front of school assemblies and had experienced only nervous excitement. So I was blindsided when, standing on stage, in the starring role in my sixth grade class's holiday performance of St. George and the Dragon, I suddenly found I could not speak. It was an evening in mid-December, and the auditorium was filled with a few dozen parents, siblings, and teachers. I remember standing backstage beforehand, awaiting my cue to enter stage left, and feeling only mildly nervous. Though it's hard for me to imagine now, I think I was even enjoying myself, looking forward to the attention I would receive as star of the play. But when I walked to center stage and looked out into the auditorium to see all those eyes upon me, my chest constricted. Research has shown that being the object of another's direct gaze is highly emotionally and physiologically arousing. One of the surest ways to cause the neurons in the amygdala of a human test subject to fire is simply to have someone stare at the subject. Many studies have demonstrated that the amygdalae of those diagnosed with social anxiety disorder tend to be consistently more reactive to the human gaze than those of healthy control subjects. After a few seconds, I found myself in the grip of both physical and emotional panic, and I could barely speak. I eked out a few quavering lines with a diminishing voice, and then arrived at a point where I could make no more words emerge. I stopped, mid-sentence, feeling that I was about to vomit. A few agonizing seconds of silence ticked by until my friend Peter, who was playing my valet, bailed me out by saying his next line. Peter, I can only assume, felt no such anxiety. He went on to become a member of President Barack Obama's first-term cabinet. This surely seemed to the audience like a non sequitur, but it moved the scene to its conclusion and mercifully got me off the stage. By my next scene, the physical symptoms of my anxiety had abated a little. At the end of the play, I slew the dragon as directed. Afterward, people said they had liked my fight scene, and, out of politeness, I was sure, nobody remarked on my first scene, where it must have looked, at best, like I had forgotten my line, or at worst, like I had frozen in terror. A trap door opened beneath me that night. After that, public performances were never the same. At the time, I was singing in a professional boys' choir that appeared in churches and auditoriums all over New England. Concerts were torture. I was not one of the better singers, so I never had solos. I was just one of 24 prepubescent boys standing anonymously on stage. But every moment was misery. I'd hold my score in front of my face so the audience couldn't see me and mouth the words silently. I'd have that horrible choking feeling, and my stomach would hurt, and I would fear that if I made any sound, I'd vomit. It didn't help that the choir director was a strange and tyrannical man who lived with his parents and had a horrific stutter. He'd start screaming at you during choir practice and would get stuck on a word. His face contorted into a paroxysm of anger and frustration, and you would have to wait many seconds for whatever expletive he was trying to direct at you to finally burst out. I quit the choir, but I couldn't completely avoid public performances, especially as my anxieties worsened and my definition of public got broader. The next year, I was making a presentation in Mr. Hunt's seventh grade science class. True to my phobic preoccupations, I had chosen to do a report on the biology of food poisoning. Standing at the front of the class, I became overwhelmed by dizziness and nausea. I made it only a few halting sentences into my presentation before pausing and then squeaking plaintively, "I don't feel well." Mr. Hunt told me to go sit down. "Maybe he's got food poisoning," a classmate joked. Everyone laughed, while I burned with humiliation. A couple of years later, I won a junior tennis tournament at a local club. Afterward, there was a luncheon banquet where trophies were to be given out. All that was required of me was to walk onto the dais when my name was called, shake the hand of the tournament director, smile for the camera, and walk off the dais again. I wouldn't even have to speak. But as the tournament organizers proceeded down through the different age groups, I started to tremble and sweat. The prospect of having all those eyes upon me was terrifying. I was sure I would humiliate myself in some indeterminate way. Several minutes before my name was announced, I slipped out the back door and ran down to a basement restroom to hide, emerging only several hours later when I was sure the luncheon had ended. This sort of extreme avoidant behavior is common among social phobics. I once came across a report in the clinical literature of a woman who, feigning illness, skipped a company banquet where she was to be given an award for outstanding performance because the prospect of being the center of attention made her so nervous. After she missed the dinner, a small group of colleagues planned a more intimate reception in her honor. She quit her job rather than attend. Once, in college, I applied for a fellowship that required me to sit for an interview with a committee of half a dozen faculty members, most of whom I was already friendly with. We bantered easily before the official proceedings began. But when the interview started and they asked me the first formal question, my chest constricted and I could make no sound emerge from my trachea. I sat there, mouth silently gaping open and then shutting like some kind of fish or suckling mammal. When finally I was able to get my voice to work, I excused myself and scurried out, feeling the committee's befuddled eyes on my back. And that was that. The problem, alas, has persisted into adulthood. There have been humiliating minor catastrophes, walking off stage mid-sentence during public presentations, and scores of near misses. Television shows where I felt the chest constriction begin, lectures and interviews where the room started to swim, nausea rose in my gullet, and my voice diminished to a sickly warble. Somehow, in many of those near-miss instances, I've managed to fight through and continue. But in all these situations, even when they're apparently going well, I feel I'm living on the razor's edge between success and failure. Adulation and humiliation, between justifying my existence and revealing my unworthiness to be alive. People are not disturbed by things, but by the view they take of them. Epictetus, On Anxiety, 1st century AD. Why does my body betray me in these situations? Performance anxiety is not some ethereal feeling, but rather a vivid mental state with concrete physical aspects that are measurable in a laboratory. Accelerated heart rate, heart palpitations, increased levels of epinephrine and norepinephrine in the bloodstream, decreased gastric motility, and elevated blood pressure. Almost everyone experiences a measurable autonomic nervous response while performing in public. Most people register a 2 to 3-fold increase in the level of norepinephrine in their bloodstream at the beginning of a lecture, a rush of adrenaline that can improve performance. But in social phobics, this autonomic response tends to be more acute, and it translates into debilitating physical symptoms and emotional distress. Studies at the University of Wisconsin have found that in the run-up to a speech, socially anxious individuals show high activation of their right cerebral hemispheres, which seems to interfere with both their logical processing and their verbal abilities, the sort of brain freeze that young Gandhi experienced in the courtroom. The experience of struggling to think or speak clearly in moments of social stress has clear biological substrates. Cognitive behavioral therapists argue that social anxiety disorder is a problem of disordered logic or faulty thinking. If we can correct our false beliefs and maladaptive attitudes, our cognitions or schema, as they say, we can cure the anxiety. Epictetus, a Greek slave and Stoic philosopher living in Rome in the 1st century AD, was the prototype of the cognitive behavioral therapist. His essay, On Anxiety, in addition to being one of the earliest contributions to the literature of self-help, seems to be the first attempt to connect performance anxiety to what we would today call issues of self-esteem. When I see anyone anxious, I say, "What does this man want?" Epictetus writes. Unless he wanted something or other not in his own power, how could he still be anxious? A musician, for instance, feels no anxiety while he is singing by himself. But when he appears upon the stage, he does, even if his voice be ever so good, or he plays ever so well. For what he wishes is not only to sing well, but likewise to gain applause. But this is not in his own power. In short, where his skill lies, there is his courage. In other words, you can't ultimately control whether the audience applauds or not, so what use is there in worrying about it? For Epictetus, anxiety was a disorder of desire and emotion to be overcome by logic. If you can train your mind to perform the same way whether you're alone or being observed, you'll not get derailed by stage fright. Two influential 20th century psychotherapists, Albert Ellis and Aaron Beck, the founders of Rational Emotive Behavioral Therapy, REBT, and Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, CBT, respectively, each argued that the treatment of social anxiety boils down to overcoming fear of disapproval. To overcome social anxiety, they say, you need to inure yourself to needless shame. To this end, when Dr. M, a practitioner in the CBT mold, was treating me at Boston University's Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders, she aimed, as a therapeutic exercise, to intentionally embarrass me. She would escort me to the university bookstore next door to the center and lurk discreetly nearby while I asked purposely dumb questions of the clerks or told them I needed a bathroom because I was going to throw up. I found this excruciatingly awkward and embarrassing, which was the whole point, and it didn't really help. But this is standard exposure therapy for social phobics. A growing body of controlled studies support its effectiveness. The idea, in part, is to demonstrate to the patient that revealing imperfection, or doing something stupid, need not mean the end of the world or the unraveling of the self. On a number of occasions, I saw other therapists from the center putting their patients through similar exposures at the same store, forcing them to ask strange questions or to make obvious and embarrassing mistakes. The store employees must have wondered why they had so many weird interactions with apparently deranged customers every day. Therapists of a more psychoanalytic bent tend to focus on the social phobic's firmly held view of himself as a deeply flawed or disgusting human being devoid of intrinsic value. Catherine Zerbe, a psychiatrist in Portland, Oregon, has written that the social phobic's biggest fear is that other people will perceive his true and inadequate self. For the social phobic, any kind of performance, musical, sporting, public speaking, can be terrifying because failure will reveal the weakness and inadequacy within. This, in turn, means constantly projecting an image that feels false, an image of confidence, competence, even perfection. Dr. W. calls this impression management, and he observes that while it can be a symptom of social anxiety, it's an even bigger cause. Once you've invested in the perpetuation of a public image that feels untrue to your core self, you feel always in danger of being exposed as a fraud. One mistake, one revelation of anxiety or weakness, and the facade of competence and accomplishment is exposed for what it is. An artificial persona designed to hide the vulnerable self that lies within. Thus, the stakes for any given performance become excruciatingly high. Success means preserving the perception of value and esteem. Failure means exposure of the shameful self one is trying so hard to hide. Impression management is exhausting and stressful. You live in constant fear that, as Dr. W. puts it, the house of cards that is your projected self will come crashing down around you. A stammering man is never a worthless one. Physiology can tell you why. It is an excess of sensibility to the presence of his fellow creature that makes him stammer. Thomas Carlyle, from a letter to Ralph Waldo Emerson, November 17, 1843. As early as 1901, Paul Hartenberg anticipated one of the key findings of modern research on social phobics. While social phobics are unusually attentive to other people's feelings, he wrote in Le Timide et la Timidité, scrutinizing the verbal intonations, facial expressions, and body language of their interlocutors for signs of how people are reacting to them, they are also unduly confident about the conclusions they draw based on those observations. And specifically about the negative conclusions they draw. That is, social phobics are better at picking up on subtle social cues than other people are, but they tend to overinterpret anything that could be construed as a negative reaction. Since they are predisposed to believe that people won't like them or will react badly to them, they tend to have obsessive thoughts like, I'm boring, or I'm going to make a fool of myself by saying something stupid. They're always seeking confirmation of this belief by interpreting, say, a suppressed yawn or a slight twitch of the mouth as disapproval. Highly anxious people read facial expressions faster than less anxious people, says R. Chris Fraley, a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. But they are also more likely to misread them. Alexander Bystritsky, the director of the Anxiety Disorders Program at UCLA, says that while anxious people do have a sensitive emotional barometer that allows them to detect subtle changes in emotion, this barometer can cause them to read too much into an expression. Social phobics are, in at least this one respect, gifted. Faster and better at picking up behavioral cues from other people, with social antennae so sensitive that they receive transmissions that normal people can't. Put the other way around, the perception of healthy people may be adaptively blunted. They may not pick up on the negative cues, that yawn of boredom or twitch of disdain, that are in fact present. Arneo Mann, a Swedish neuroscientist at Uppsala University, who has written extensively about the evolutionary biology of phobic behavior, believes that oversensitive emotional barometers are genetically hardwired into social phobics, causing them to be acutely aware of social status in interpersonal interactions. Consider the case of Ned, a 56-year-old dentist who had been in practice for 3 decades. To outward appearances, Ned was successful. But when he showed up in a psychiatrist's office, Ned said his career had been destroyed by his fear of doing something foolish. Ned's case is drawn from John Marshall's book, Social Phobia. Anxiety about doing something wrong that will lead to social humiliation is quite common. But Ned's fear was interestingly specific. His performance anxiety was only acute when working on patients whom he perceived, based on the kind of insurance they carried, to have social status greater than he did. While he worked on Medicaid patients or those without insurance, his anxiety was negligible. But while treating patients with fancy insurance, indicative of a high-status job, Ned was terrified that his hands would shake visibly or that he would sweat excessively, revealing his anxiety to his patients, who he believed were immune to anxiety and, as he put it, completely at home in the world, and therefore prone to judge and even to ridicule him for his weakness. Symptoms of this kind of status-based social anxiety, and particularly the fear of being exposed as weak relative to one's peers, appear regularly in the psychiatric literature going back a century, and lots of evidence supports Oman's proposition that people like Ned have an awareness of social status and of social slights that is too finely calibrated. A National Institute of Mental Health study published in 2008 found that the brains of people with generalized social phobia responded differently to criticism than the brains of other people. When social phobics and healthy control subjects read neutral comments about themselves, their brain activity looked the same. But when the two groups read negative comments about themselves, those diagnosed with social anxiety disorder had markedly increased blood flow to the amygdala and the medial prefrontal cortex, two parts of the brain associated with anxiety and the stress response. The brains of social phobics appear physiologically primed to be hyper-responsive to negative comments. This finding aligns with the many studies showing that social phobics demonstrate a more hyper-reactive amygdala response to negative facial expressions. When social phobics see faces that appear angry, frightened, or disapproving, the neurons in their amygdalae fire faster and more intensively than those of healthy control subjects. As the NIMH researchers put it, generalized social phobia-related dysfunction may at least partly reflect a negative attitude toward the self, particularly in response to social stimuli, as instantiated in the medial prefrontal cortex. What this means in plain English is that shame and low self-esteem have a biological address. They reside, evidently, in the interconnections between the amygdala and the medial prefrontal cortex. There's now a whole subgenre of fMRI studies that demonstrate that the amygdala reacts vividly to social stimuli not perceived by the conscious mind. When individuals are placed in an fMRI machine and shown images of faces displaying fear or anger, their amygdalae flare with activity. This is not surprising. We know that the amygdala is the seat of the fear response. It's also not surprising that neurons in the amygdalae of diagnosed social phobics tend to fire more frequently and intensively than those of other people in response to frightened or angry faces. What is surprising is that all people, social phobics and healthy control subjects alike, show a marked amygdala response to photos they are not consciously aware of seeing. That is, if you watch a slideshow of innocuous images of flowers, interspersed with pictures of scared or angry faces flashed so quickly you are not consciously aware of seeing them, your amygdala will flare in response to the emotional faces, even though you don't know you saw them. Ask the test subjects in these experiments whether they saw the scared or angry faces, and they will say they did not. The images flashed by too quickly for the conscious brain to register them. But the amygdala, operating with lightning-fast acuity beneath the level of conscious awareness, perceives the distressing faces and flares in the fMRI. Some subjects report feeling anxiety at these moments, but they can't identify its source. This would seem to be neuroscientific evidence that Freud was right about the existence of the unconscious. The brain reacts powerfully to stimuli that we are not explicitly aware of. Hundreds of studies reveal an unconscious neurobiological stress response to social stimuli. To cite just one, a 2008 study published in the Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience found that people shown images of emotional faces for 30 milliseconds, faster than the conscious mind can perceive them, demonstrated marked brain responses. The socially anxious had the strongest brain responses. Fascinatingly, when test subjects were asked to judge whether images of surprised faces were positive or negative, their judgments were powerfully affected by the subliminal images flashed just beforehand. When the image of the surprised face was preceded by a subliminal image of an angry or scared face, subjects were much more likely to say that the surprised face they were looking at was negative, expressing fear or anger. When the image of the same surprised face was preceded by a flashed happy face, the test subjects were more likely to say the same surprised face was expressing joy. As one of the researchers put it, unconsciously perceived signals of threat bubble up and unwittingly influence social judgments. What's the point of having such finely tuned social perception equipment? Why do our brains make judgments we're not consciously aware of? One theory is that such quick social judging historically enhanced our odds of survival. In a baboon troop or a tribe of hunter-gatherers, you don't want to make social impressions that will invite attacks from your peers or cause you to be banished. For baboons, being kicked out of the troop is often tantamount to death. A lone monkey found by another group is likely to be set upon and killed. To be an early human banished from the tribe was to be both denied access to communal food supplies and rendered vulnerable to animal predators. Thus, a certain social sensitivity, a keen attunement to what group norms demand, an awareness of social threats, a sense of how to signal the deference that will keep you from getting pummeled by a higher status member of your troop or banished from your tribe, is adaptive. This is where blushing can be helpful as an automatic signal of deference to others. Being aware of how your social behavior, your performance, is being perceived by others can help you stay alive. Calling attention to yourself and being judged negatively is always risky. You're in danger of having your status challenged or of being kicked out of the tribe for making a bad impression. Some social phobics find even positive attention to be aversive. Think of the young child who bursts into tears when guests sing happy birthday to her at a party, or of Elfriede Jelinek, afraid to pick up her Nobel Prize. Social attention, even positive, supportive attention, activates the neurocircuitry of fear. This makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. Calling positive attention to yourself can incite jealousy or generate new rivalries. Murray Stein, a psychiatrist at the University of California, San Diego, has observed that social submissiveness in baboons and other primates has striking parallels with social phobia in humans. The stress that social phobics feel in anticipation of normal human interactions, and especially of public performances, Stein says, produces the same hypercortisolism, an elevation in the levels of stress hormones and an activation of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal, HPA, axis that subordinate status does in baboons. Hypercortisolism, in turn, kindles the amygdala, which has the effect of both intensifying anxiety in the moment and tying social interactions more deeply to a stress response in the future. The phobic response gets deeply consolidated in the neurons of the amygdala and the hippocampus, which is in part what makes it so hard to stamp out phobias. In this way, anxiety can be wretchedly self-reinforcing. Stress activates the amygdala, which increases anxiety. Increased anxiety stimulates the HPA axis, which makes the amygdala twitchier still. And all of this neural activity deepens the association of anxiety with the phobic stimulus, whether that's social interaction or a turbulent plane flight. In short, being anxious conditions you to be more anxious in the future. Stein's research builds on the work of Robert Sapolsky, a neurobiologist at Stanford, who has done fascinating research showing a direct correlation between a baboon's status in his troop and the quantity of stress hormones in his blood. Baboon populations have strictly ordered male hierarchies. There is the alpha male, who is usually the biggest and strongest and has the most access to food and females and is deferred to by all the other male monkeys. Then there is the second highest ranking monkey, who is deferred to by all the other monkeys except for the alpha male, and so on, all the way down to the lowest ranking male at the bottom of the social ladder. If a fight breaks out between two baboons and the higher ranking one wins, the social order is preserved. If the lower ranking one wins, there is a resorting, with the victorious baboon moving up the social ladder. Through careful observation, Sapolsky's team has been able to determine the social hierarchies of particular baboon populations. Using blood tests from these primates, Sapolsky has found that testosterone levels correlate directly with social standing. The higher ranking the baboon, the more testosterone he'll have. Moreover, when a baboon rises in the social hierarchy, the amount of testosterone he produces increases. When a baboon declines in status, his testosterone levels fall. The causation seems to work in both directions. Testosterone produces dominance, and dominance produces testosterone. But just as higher rank is associated with testosterone, lower rank is associated with stress hormones like cortisol. The lower a baboon's standing in the hierarchy, the greater the concentration of stress hormones in his blood. A subordinate male not only has to work harder to procure food and access to females, but also has to tread carefully so as not to get beaten up by a dominant animal. It's unclear whether high levels of cortisol cause a baboon to become submissive or whether the stress of being low status causes cortisol levels to rise. Most likely it's both. The physical and psychological pressures of being a subordinate baboon lead to elevated levels of stress hormones, which produce more anxiety, which produces more stress hormones, which produce more submissiveness and general ill health. While findings from animal studies can be applied to our understanding of human nature only indirectly, we can reason in ways other primates cannot. Ned's anxious response to practicing dentistry on higher status patients may well have its roots in primitive concerns about overstepping bounds in the status hierarchy. Low-ranking baboons and orangutans that fail to lower their eyes to signal their submissiveness in the presence of higher-ranking ones risk inviting attack. A baboon's status in the social hierarchy, and beyond that, his skillfulness at behaving in accord with his rank, whatever that may be, does a lot to determine his physical well-being. Interestingly, recent studies have found that the happiest-seeming and least stressed monkeys are what we might call the beta males, those monkeys near the top of the hierarchy who tend to be easygoing and socially skillful. Being the highest-ranking male is a lot healthier and less stressful than being the lowest-ranking male, but being a high-ranking male who is not the highest-ranking male is even more healthy and less stressful, because you're not always having to worry about the palace coup that threatens to topple you. Both low-ranking baboons and humans with social anxiety disorder resort easily to submissive behavior. Like low-ranking animals, people with the general subtype of social anxiety disorder tend to look downward, avoid eye contact, blush, and engage in behaviors that advertise their submissiveness, eagerly seeking to please their peers and superiors and actively deferring to others to avoid conflict. For low-ranking baboons, this behavior is a protective adaptation. It can be adaptive in humans, too. But in social phobics, it is more often self-defeating. Low-status monkeys and socially phobic humans also tend to have notable irregularities in the processing of certain neurotransmitters. Studies have found that monkeys with enhanced serotonergic function, in essence, higher levels of serotonin in their brain synapses, tend to be more dominant, more friendly, and more likely to bond with their peers than those with normal serotonin levels. In contrast, monkeys with unusually low serotonin levels are more likely to display avoidant behavior. They keep to themselves and avoid social interactions. Recent studies of humans have found altered serotonin function in certain brain regions of patients diagnosed with social anxiety disorder. These findings help explain why selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac and Paxil can be effective in treating social anxiety. Studies have also found that when non-anxious, non-depressed people take SSRIs, they become more friendly. Dopamine has also been implicated in shaping social behavior. When monkeys who have been housed alone are taken from their cages and placed into a group setting, the monkeys that rise the highest in the dominance hierarchy tend to have more dopamine in their brains, which is interesting in light of studies finding that people diagnosed with social anxiety disorder tend to have lower than average dopamine levels. Some studies have found striking correlations between social anxiety and Parkinson's disease, a neurological condition associated with a deficit of dopamine in the brain. One 2008 study found that half of Parkinson's patients scored high enough on the Liebowitz Social Anxiety Scale to be diagnosed with social phobia. Multiple recent studies have found altered dopamine binding potential in the brains of the socially anxious. All drugs of abuse elevate dopamine levels in the basal ganglia, an area of the brain where dopamine is low in socially anxious patients. A chronic dopamine deficit may help account for why social phobics are more likely than others to struggle with addiction. Murray Stein, among others, has hypothesized that the awkwardness and interpersonal clumsiness of social phobics are directly connected to problems in dopamine functioning. The dopamine reinforcement reward pathways that help guide correct social behavior in healthy people may somehow be askew in the brains of social phobics. My sister, who has for years suffered from social anxiety, strongly endorses this view. Without knowing anything about neurobiology, she has long insisted that her brain is wired wrong. Social situations that normal people breeze through unthinkingly cause my brain to shut down, she says. I can never think of what to say. Though her brain otherwise functions well, she's a successful cartoonist, editor, and children's book author who graduated from Harvard, she has, ever since junior high, wrestled with what she calls her talking problem. Neither decades of psychotherapy nor dozens of drug combinations have much alleviated it. She has been evaluated for Asperger's syndrome and other disorders on the autism spectrum, but she doesn't lack empathy the way Asperger's patients do. Although Asperger's patients and social phobics in some ways suffer from a similar problem, a difficulty in managing social interactions that puts off others, they arrive at it from more or less opposite directions. Whereas the Asperger's patient is no good at imagining what's in other people's minds, the social phobic is too good at it. The association of dopamine and serotonin with social phobia doesn't prove that neurotransmitter deficits cause social anxiety. Those irregularities could be the effects of social anxiety, the neurochemical scars that develop when a brain becomes overstressed from having to be so vigilant all the time, constantly scanning the environment for social threats. But emerging research suggests that the efficiency with which dopamine and serotonin get ferried across the synapses is genetically determined. Researchers have found that which variant of the serotonin transporter gene you have determines the density of serotonin receptors in your neurons, and that the relative density of your serotonin receptors helps determine where you fall on the spectrum between shy and extroverted. I will discuss the relation between genes and anxiety in greater depth in Chapter 9. The introduction of social uncertainty into a group of baboons does interesting things to rates of anxiety. Low-ranking baboons are always stressed. But Robert Sapolsky has found that whenever a new male joins the troop, the glucocorticoid levels of all the baboons, not just the low-ranking ones, become elevated. With the introduction of new members into a social hierarchy, appropriate rules of conduct, such as who should defer to whom, become unclear. There are more fights and general agitation. Once the new baboon has been assimilated into the tribe, stress levels and glucocorticoid concentrations decline, and social behavior returns to normal. This also happens in humans. In the late 1990s, Dirk Hellhammer, a German psychobiologist, coded 63 army recruits at boot camp according to their relative position in the social hierarchy, as determined by anthropological observation, and then measured their cortisol levels every week. During stable periods, the more dominant recruits had lower baseline levels of salivary cortisol than the subordinate ones, just like baboons. But during periods of experimentally induced psychological and physical stress, cortisol levels increased in all the soldiers, markedly in the dominant subjects and modestly in the subordinate ones. While it's always stressful being a low-ranking member of the tribe, disruptions to the social order seem to make everyone, even the high-ranking members, stressed. One of the hallmarks of modernity is an abiding uncertainty about status. Hunter-gatherer societies tended not to be very socially stratified. For most of human history, people lived in fairly egalitarian groups. That changed during the Middle Ages. From the 12th century or so all the way through the American Revolution, society was highly stratified, but also largely fixed. People didn't move between feudal castes. Modern society, in contrast, is both highly stratified, there's a high degree of income inequality in many countries, and highly fluid. The notion that anyone can, with luck and pluck, rise from poverty to the middle class, or from the middle class to great wealth, is integral to our idea of success. But not all mobility is upward. Unlike in a society with more fixed socioeconomic strata, there is always the fear of falling, a fear that is heightened in economic times like these. The many forces bearing down on the American worker, the creative destruction of free market capitalism, the disruptions to the labor force caused by technology, the changing and uncertain relations between the sexes, and the accompanying confusion about gender roles combine to produce constant uncertainty. People naturally worry, am I being overtaken by other people with more relevant job skills? Will I lose my job and fall out of the middle class? Some have argued that this chronic uncertainty is physically rewiring our brains to be more anxious. Many of us have strived for perfection in order to try to control our world. There is generally a deep-seated feeling of not being good enough, of being deficient or defective in some way, or of being different from others in a way that will not be accepted by others. This creates a feeling of shame and a fear of embarrassment and humiliation in exposing your true self in front of others. Janet Esposito, In the Spotlight, 2000. Recently, while sifting through the records from my treatment with Dr. M nearly a decade ago, I came across a document I'd written at her request. She had asked me to write down what the outcome of a worst-case scenario public speaking catastrophe would be for me. The idea behind this sort of exercise is to fully imagine the worst thing that could happen. Total failure. Complete humiliation. And then, once you've really thought about it, to conclude that first, the worst-case scenario was unlikely to unfold, and second, even if it did, maybe it would not be so shatteringly catastrophic. Reaching that conclusion and assimilating it intellectually and emotionally is supposed to lower the stakes of the performance and therefore diminish anxiety. That's the theory, anyway. But when I showed up at my lunchtime appointment one Thursday, after having emailed her my imagined worst-case public speaking scenario, humiliation and physical collapse, followed by unemployment, divorce, and ostracism from society, Dr. M. looked stricken. "Your write-up," she said. It's the most negative thing I've ever read. She told me she had been horrified at what I'd written and had felt compelled to show my account to her department supervisor in search of more experienced counsel. As she looked at me with sympathy, concern, and I believe no small alarm, I suspected she'd raised the question of whether I might be gravely depressed and possibly psychotic. Perhaps I have an overactive imagination. Perhaps I'm unduly pessimistic. But I now know that negativity and poor self-image, along with a desperate desire to conceal that poor self-image, are textbook for a social phobic. Nearly every book on the subject, both popular and academic, observes that social anxiety disorder is associated with feelings of inferiority and with extreme sensitivity to any kind of criticism or negative evaluation. Even, and perhaps especially, psychotherapists are not immune. Because they feel patients and peers look to them to be in control of their emotions, the pressure psychotherapists put on themselves not to appear anxious or agitated can be great, and can perversely make them feel more anxious and out of control. I have on my shelf several books by therapists who have at times felt handicapped and humiliated by their own anxiety. The Anxiety Expert, A Psychiatrist's Story of Panic, 2004, was written by Marjorie Raskin, a psychiatrist specializing in anxiety who was tortured by panic attacks brought on by public speaking. She went to great lengths to hide her anxiety and, like me, medicated herself heavily with benzodiazepines. Painfully Shy, How to Overcome Social Anxiety and Reclaim Your Life, 2001, was co-written by a psychologist, Barbara Markway, who concedes that she herself has not, in fact, ever fully overcome her social anxiety or reclaimed her life. "Geez," Dr. W. said to me one day when I was explaining to him the high stakes I ascribed to an upcoming public event and how important I thought it was to maintain my facade of efficacy and to hide my sense of fraudulence and weakness. "Do you realize how potently your sense of shame contributes to your anxiety?" Both Dr. M. and Dr. W., not to mention Epictetus, would say that the best cure for this kind of social anxiety is to